Happy New Year to all the constant listeners out there. Nick Deolius. This is the Far Middle Podcast. Again, I want to wish you a Happy New Year. It is 2022. It's here. In a lot of ways, I guess, unfortunately, in some of those, it feels a lot like 2021 already with everything going on with the pandemic and the inevitable impacts that the economy and just society and life are dealing with. But nevertheless, we've got a new year and a whole bunch of items and issues to discuss and exciting things to talk about. Now, this is episode 33. Who am I going with on this dedication? Well, first, I got to apologize to a couple of individuals that could have had, you know, very well-deserved dedications for this episode. First being Tony Dorsett of Hopewell and Aliquippa, outside of Pittsburgh fame, and of course, Pitt with the Heisman and that great NFL career that he had, even though he played for the Cowboys and he played for the Panthers at Pitt, my rival to the Penn State Nittany Lions. Always loved Tony Dorsett and everything he did throughout his career. And also apologies to Patrick Waugh, the great goalie for the Canadiens and Avalanche. But as we said a couple of episodes back, Martin Brodeur, from my perspective, gets top nod as top goalie of his era, as great as Patrick Waugh was. Now I'm going to go with, for number 33, Larry Bird, Larry Legend of the Boston Celtics, of course. And I guess, you know, the start of all this, why I land on Larry Bird, not just because I always enjoyed watching him and loved him as an athlete, but just because of his background and what he overcame. You talk about individuals that have had to deal with or overcome adversity through their lives, especially their earlier lives. I mean, Larry Bird is sort of front and center as an example of that. Grew up poor in, of course, French Lick, Indiana. I think everybody now who's a basketball fan puts French Lick on the basketball map because of Larry Bird. Had a single mom, lost his dad somewhere along the line, I think, and during his high school years to a tragic suicide. Had a lot of siblings in his family that he had to look after. So times were certainly tough and challenging growing up. He got a scholarship to play basketball at Indiana, so Indiana University, where Bob Knight was. But he got to Bloomington, and the city itself and the campus itself was so large compared to what he was used to and comfortable with at French Lick and at his high school. He just basically got stressed out and basically left. He just exited IU and quit and took a bit of a gap year, I would call it, off in between IU and then Indiana State, where he ultimately landed. And of course, everybody's familiar with that great 1979 season, where he led Indiana State to the NCAA Finals. Who did they play? They played that Michigan State team. They had a player on that team by the name of Magic Johnson, and thus probably the most epic rivalry, friendship, whatever you want to call it, in NBA history began with Magic Johnson and Larry Bird. And boy, wasn't that fun to watch through the years. Larry was College Player of the Year in 79. Again, thinking of Magic Johnson and Larry Bird, I sort of view them in one and the same. I sort of can't separate them in my mind. And so I guess I sort of dedicate episode 33 not just to Larry Bird, but also to Magic Johnson. I'm still sort of feeling a bit guilty. In our prior episode, we didn't dedicate it to Magic. But when you got somebody like Jim Brown sitting there, it's hard to overpass him or forget about him. And, you know, Larry Bird's accolades, I think everybody's familiar with him. Three-time NBA champ, league MVP three times. He was a finals MVP twice. And another thing about Larry Bird that was pretty impressive to watch and observe after he stopped playing as a player was he got a Coach of the Year nod when he became a coach in the NBA and also an Executive of the Year nod. So, you know, he did it across three different facets: player, coach, and then front office executive. Just shows sort of the basketball IQ of that guy. Now, sort of three unofficial or non-statistics thoughts about Larry Bird that came to mind maybe to share with you. One, I don't know if you guys know this, but Twitter, you know, its logos at that bird. The Twitter logo's name that the Twitter team gave it was Larry, and they named it Larry because of Larry Bird. So every time you see Twitter, and you can follow me on Twitter, at Nick Deolius, and you see that logo, think of Larry Bird, because the Twitter logo's name is sort of designated as a nod to Bird. Second thought when it comes to Larry Bird, I had a video game, and I'm not sure if any of you had this as well back in the day. This was probably, I'd say, mid-80s. of Dr. J versus Larry Bird. And I can't remember on what computer system it was on. I don't know if it was like a Commodore or an Atari or whichever one it was. But Larry Bird and Dr. J, you could play the computer. You could pick either player, and the computer would be the other player. Or you could have a friend and play along, and the two of you could switch players. That was, I had a lot of fun with that game in particular. And then there's also, I came across this. There's a guy who committed a crime, a serious crime, and he was facing his sentencing. So the judge at the trial sentenced him to 30 years of prison for this serious crime that the defendant had committed. And the individual requested to the judge to change the sentencing from 30 years to 33 years because the defendant was a Larry Bird fan. So I'm not sure what to think about that. I guess that's taking your liking of a player to a whole new level when you're basically sentenced to a 30-year prison term and you're asking for 33 so that it matches your favorite player's number. But there you have it. Yeah, you know, Larry Bird, Magic Johnson, the Pistons with Isaiah Thomas and Bill Laimbeer, Dr. J, and then I guess a young Michael Jordan coming up in the mid-late 80s. Best NBA era. Best NBA era ever, for sure. Now, just like we did in 2021 with the Far Middle Podcast episodes, we're going to do the same thing in 22. We're going to connect dots. So we got Larry Bird that we started and kicked this off with episode 33. I'm going to connect him to, of all things, the second dot of wine. And what does Larry Bird and wine have to do with one another? Well, what's interesting to me, one of the most interesting things to me about Larry Bird was that his performance on the court was the essence of what he was and how he was viewed. He was not a manufactured or Madison Avenue marketed entity or brand, right? In fact, he was sort of the anti-brand. His optics worked against him because, you know, he wasn't the sleekest of athletes and he wasn't the most graceful out there on the court. The Celtics uniforms weren't the most glamorous by any stretch. But when you saw him perform, that's all that mattered. All the other stuff went away, didn't matter. When he performed, he was at the top of his craft, along with a handful of others, those contemporaries of his that I mentioned. Now compare that and how sort of the substance is all that matters, and it's there for everyone to see. Compare it to other things that we may enjoy or consume where it's the exact opposite situation. The optics are all that matters. And of all things, what I want to bring up as a sort of alter ego to Larry Bird is, as I said, wine. What makes for a successful commercial endeavor when it comes to wine, and what would lead to its failure, its non-success? And I thought about this doing some shopping, getting ready for the holidays that just passed, and going into, in Pennsylvania, you really can't buy alcohol anywhere outside of a state government, state-owned store, state store we call them. So I'm in the state store. It's one of the crazy things, archaic things about Pennsylvania liquor laws. But I'm in the state store and I'm looking at all these different wine bottles and how they're arranged and what they say on the labels. And I'm thinking of all these people in the store who, you know, they may enjoy wine, but they probably aren't experts, or at least most of them aren't experts, like myself, novices. How are they making decisions on which wine bottle to buy, which one to purchase, and which one to pass over? So I went back and I started thinking, well, you know, there's those statistics that show these experts in wine that were blindfolded and did these now famous taste tests of 100 bottle of wine next to a $15 bottle of wine, and these, even the experts, not being able to statistically show a differentiation between the really expensive wine and the cheaper bottle of wine. So if that's how the experts are doing on a blindfolded basis, then a novice like myself, or most people that are buying wine, couldn't tell the difference likely either. So then what is the determinant? What is driving our decision-making? Well, I came down to basically three things that will drive your decision to purchase a bottle of wine. One is going to be word of mouth. Somebody that you know or you're friends with or in your family or that you trust tells you, hey, try this type of wine, this brand, this label of wine. It's really good. So there's always the word of mouth approach, which you see everywhere, right, in just sort of consumerism today. The second thing will be some authority that is just accepted as an expert on wine that is scoring these things. So this is where you see those labels on the bottles, where Wine Spectator or Wine Enthusiast is scoring this type of wine in the 90s, right? It gets a high score. Now, I have no idea, and I think most people that look at those scores have no idea how those scores are tabulated. We don't know what the process is, what the matrix is, what the metrics are. We just take it as a given that Wine Enthusiast or Wine Spectator, whoever it is, they know what they're talking about, and 94 is a good number, and it's going to equate to a great bottle of wine. Complete blind faith without any understanding of what's behind the entire process itself that leads to that score. And then there's the third driver, which indeterminate, which I think is the biggest. Personally, I think this is really the driver for the majority of people that are just out there buying wine to either, you know, consume themselves or to present as gifts, whatever the case might be. And that is the label on the bottle, how it looks, and the name of the wine itself. I think it's just the pure marketing shtick, okay? Obviously, the label and how it appears and the name of the wine have nothing to do with the quality of the wine, but I would posit that that is the major determinant of what bottle ends up getting purchased and which one ends up not getting purchased. So in a lot of ways, I guess wine is the opposite of Larry Bird. For wine, the optics are all that matters in most instances, not the substance. You figure out the substance later, and you probably wouldn't know the difference because it's tough to, right, compare in your head at that moment what it would have been like under a different alternate wine because you just don't have it right in front of you. And thinking about now, going back to sports, are sports and sports stars, are they becoming more like the wine industry is, or is the wine industry moving more towards what the Larry Bird situation was, where, call it the consistency, objective scoring, and the quality of the wine itself is taking sort of a bigger role in what ultimately is successful, what ultimately gets purchased versus just the optics. I think the sports stars are moving closer to the current wine world than vice versa. I think current sports stars are worrying much more about their personal branding than their on-the-field performance or the performance of their team. You can see that with the Twitter feeds and the TikToks. The me first mentality, right? Team later. So I think professional sports and athletes are moving more towards what the determinants are of success when it comes to wine and wine endeavors commercially than what was the formula for success of someone like a Larry Bird. Now let's jump from that thought of wine and what makes a commercial endeavor in the industry of wine and jump to something where I saw a lot of wine and a lot of spirits that were flowing, which was a recent party of a friend of mine back from high school days that he held in over the holidays here around Christmas time, where he had scores of people that I hadn't seen in a while, really before pandemic. All of us basically have been grown up together, gone to high school together, and had a big get-together for the holidays. He does that every year. And again, had to put on a bit of a hiatus because of COVID, but was able to put it back together here at the end of 2021. So I saw that wider friend group. And as I said, the spirits were flowing freely. That hasn't changed about that crew for sure. By the way, one of the, just to give you another sort of optics example when it comes to alcohol, not in the arena of wine, but this was bourbon. I see that Terry Bradshaw, I saw that at the party. Terry Bradshaw now has his own line of bourbon. And of course, because it's Terry Bradshaw bourbon and it's got a nice sort of decal on the bottle, there were a lot of people at that party that were interested in not just, you know, trying it out, but also buying a bottle of it and putting it on their shelf. So again, it's another example of optics in the arena of alcohol and spirits where the marketing means an awful lot. Don't know if the bourbon was any good. I'm not a bourbon guy, but couldn't tell you if it was great or horrible. You have to assess that for yourself. But one of the things that I took away from this party, well, a couple of things actually. First, time flies. We all know that, but man, does time fly. You see these individuals that I grew up with and have been lifelong friends with, their kids are there now. Their kids are adults. Some of the kids are getting married, which is a frightening thought, which I assume will mean that some of those people that I'm friends with are going to start to become grandparents before you know it. I never thought I'd be standing in a situation or at an age where that is happening, but there you have it. It is happening. So to all of you out there, I know a lot of you already know this, but if you haven't accepted it yet, time will fly faster than you realize. don't blink, you'll probably miss something. Another observation that rang loud and true is that people, the human condition, it likes being with other people. So people will miss being with people. And looking at sort of where the mindset was of individuals in the group at that event and just seeing sort of others across wider circles beyond that party, I think people have generally resigned themselves that it may be pandemic or COVID isn't going away, but we're going to get back to normal to some large extent. And I see that, I feel that, whether you know people were vaccinated, not vaccinated, people are, it doesn't matter what sort of stance, position, age, or health condition, frankly, they're in, there is this drive towards moving much closer to what was viewed as normal before COVID and pandemic. Don't know what to make of that, right? I think it depends on the individuals and the situations. I'm not so sure if I'd take that approach if I were, say, elderly and or I had pre-existing conditions, right, or I wasn't vaccinated. But nevertheless, I sense that across the board. People have sort of had enough and they've resigned themselves to, okay, this is a perhaps new risk that is on the scene, but we have to live our lives because if we don't, we're losing much more than we're gaining by risk mitigation. Another thing that came away, and this has always been something that's front and center for Western Pennsylvania. You know, Western Pennsylvania is largely flyover country, as coastal and urban elites on the coast like to view it and designate it. And the difference, one of the big differences between flyover country and the coastal urban centers, I know there's a lot of differences, but one of the biggest ones that doesn't get as much attention, doesn't get highlighted as much as it should, are what I'll call the ties that bind. Again, at this party, you had three generations that were coming together that were soon going to be, I think, four generations. You had all my sort of friends that were of one age group. A lot of our parents that are still around and able to get out, they were there. They showed up because they oftentimes live in the same neighborhoods that that their kids live in, right? We grew up in certain neighborhoods and haven't moved far afield in many instances. So the parents are there. And then, as I said, the kids, in some instances, the adult kids of friends were there as well. So you got three generations, the ties that bind. You're not going to see that type of a situation, that lineage, in Manhattan or in Hollywood. You're just not. And I think that's a shame because I think it's pretty awesome to see it and experience it on a regular basis. You sort of have much stronger ties to the region and a little corner of the world that you live in when you see that front and center. And then another observation, there was a handful of friends that attended this event that sort of flew in for it. They were either in for the holidays to visit family or they came in just to see friends, whatever the case might be. And you can sense when you're talking to them, they're melancholy when they realize and they're thinking about it's time to head back to wherever home is for them at this point in time. You know, they miss Western Pennsylvania. They miss the Pittsburgh region and they miss being with what they know the best. So I guess, you know, my major takeaway from the holiday party of the buddy of mine that held it was that in places like Western Pennsylvania, in flyover country, you indeed can still go home again. And speaking of home or going home again, let's talk about not just going home, but also leaving home. Now, I think you might have been seeing or reading about, you know, some of the new inflow and outflow numbers when it comes to populations in different states. And the popular storylines or headlines are things like blue states, whether it's California or New York, Illinois, they're losing, you know, scores of their people. But then the red states, whether it's Texas or Florida, the Carolinas, they're adding people. Their populations are growing. So that's sort of the popular headline. I think that's a little bit superficial. I don't think it's a red and blue Republican Democrat thing. I think those are just the symptoms that they happen to be Republican or Democrat in general. I think the root causes and the root drivers are more fundamental. I think that when you look at the gainers, right, those gaining population, the winners, so to speak, it's those regions and areas of the nation that embrace capitalism and free enterprise and individual rights. I mean, those are the ones that are doing well and the areas that are doing good. And then who are losing population and who are losing economically? It's those areas that are embracing the left and high taxes and big government, high crime issues, right? The collective, where the collective matters more, the common good matters more than what's best for the individual and for the individual determining that those are the ones that are losing. And if you think about this and sort of go from state to state and think about us as a nation, I start to get concerned. I mean, first thing that concerns me is the United States, you know, within our borders, are we going through our own version of the Berlin Wall, where people are fleeing, you know, one side to get to the other, you know, freeing one sort of oppressive side to get to a freer version of the other side? And if so, you know, what are the barriers that might start to be constructed to stop that, especially from the perspective of the left or those that favor big government and high taxes and those types of things? And you see this, I think, most exemplary when it comes to the situation in California. That's the ultimate case in point. And I think it's the ultimate example because everything outside of man's control, California has going for it. It's got the weather, which is awesome, the size of the state and sort of the diversity of the geography. You got everything you can imagine there. You got the ocean, you got the shore, you got the mountains, you got big cities, you got rural, you got everything. California has everything going for it outside of what man can directly control. And despite all that, California is losing twice as many people to domestic migration out of state as it was before the pandemic. So, you know, the bleeding for California's population, it was bleeding before pandemic, but think about it now where the bleeding is now occurring at twice the rate. The bleeding's intensified. It hasn't abated. So thinking through California and sort of this, you know, good state, bad state, right? The free enterprise, capitalism, individual being good state or good region, big government, the left, the collective being sort of bad region, bad state, not so much just simply a blue-red thing, then here's a serious question for us. What happens when the United States in total, could be via the federal government, the current administration, you know, whatever or however you want to view it, but what happens when as a nation we start to copy and emulate all these failed programs and tactics and strategies that you see in the Californias and the Illinois and the New Yorks? So as a nation, when we become more of that, then what happens? Where are we all going to move to? We're all going to move to New Zealand? I don't know where we're going. And it's something that sort of has not just my interest and attention, but it also has my concern. And what I'm really concerned about is that time. Is that time that that's going to occur? Is that approaching sooner than we think? When I would just stated with California, of course, pandemic policy was a big driver the past few years on why people, you know, want to leave the state and then go try to move to set up shop in another state, which means if we're talking about pandemic policy and COVID policy, it's time to now introduce and connect the next dot, which is our intermittent feature that I think we're going to start to adopt in future Far Middle podcast episodes. I call it mask mania. And this is going to look at the extreme behaviors on both ends of the spectrum. So this is on the left and the right. These behaviors that are being adopted regarding masks for the sake of nothing more than fighting. It's all a bunch of kabuki theater, has nothing to do with wellness and the science or anything else. It's just fighting over mask issues for the sake of fighting over them. So this week, for I guess our first installment of our mask mania feature, we got a great pair of yin and yang to talk about and present to you. First, on the one side, we've got a director of the Federal Center for Disease Control who still insists that school kids should be wearing masks while in class, even though, right, school kids are super low risk of, you know, experiencing some sort of severity when it comes to COVID. And even though kids might end up being vaccinated, right, which would make them even super, super low risk in terms of a demographic. And even though the science, right, here I go again, following the science, and science sort of exemplified by the rest of the world's policy. So if you look at all kinds of other nations and countries, they're moving away from mask requirements for kids in schools. And even though we know that masks will impede the learning process from communication skills to interaction with the instructor and fellow students and everything else. So despite all those facts and all those experiences and things that we now know, nothing more than pure theater is going on here that degrades the trust in government and the bureaucrats. So this is just pure posturing by a government bureaucrat and wants masks on kids because it looks good to be able to take that position. And the rest of us, we hear that, and what does it do? It degrades the trust that we have, or what little trust we had in government to begin with, and the bureaucrats that are running it. So that's sort of the yin of our mask mania feature for this episode of The Far Middle. Now, what about the yang? Well, the yang side happened down in Florida. So down in Florida, the governor, DeSantis, he nominated an individual to be state surgeon general. That's an important position, right, in any state, certainly really crucial and important in the era of pandemic. And he's got a confirmation vote that was coming up. So what's he doing? He's out there lobbying different legislators in the Florida Senate that is going to have a say-so in whether he becomes the state surgeon general. So he's visiting one state senator, and she asked him to wear a mask when he was visiting her in her office. He refused to do that. So he refused to do that, but then he said, I'll offer to meet with you outside of your office. And her explanation, her response was, well, that's all well and good, but the reason I need you to wear a mask, or I'm asking you to wear a mask, is that I've been diagnosed with cancer, and I'm going to have to begin treatments in the next week, radiation treatments. So I want to remain as healthy as I can. I don't want to go into this battle that I'm about to embark upon, contracting COVID, or even just getting a common cold for that matter. So he's still this nominee for Surgeon General. This is the nominee for Surgeon General, still refused to wear a mask. So she didn't want to go outside. The senator did not want to go outside to meet with him. She asked him to leave. He did. So, you know, what's this left with? Well, here you go on the other side, right? The yang of mask mania. What happened to a little common sense? What happened to a modicum of respect for your fellow human being? Forget about COVID and pandemic. I mean, the woman is going through and about to go through a battle with respect to cancer and cancer treatments. Did you really need to take the optical stance of refusing to wear a mask under any type of a situation? Again, for pure theater purposes. So that's our pair of winners this episode of The Far Middle when it comes to our mask mania segment. I've got a feeling we're going to be able to continue with this intermittently in future episodes, because I don't think the mania regarding masks are going anywhere anytime soon. Yeah, while I'm thinking through mask mania as a potential intermittent segment of The Far Middle, I might also add to it the Fauci focus, because I've been following a lot with respect to what he had said or has been saying, position, et cetera, versus data and evolving understanding. It's been really interesting because Dr. Fauci, I guess, is a bit of a scientist, right, and a bit of a politician. And I just get the feel that as time goes on, he's sort of leaning more towards the being a politician than a scientist. But maybe we'll talk about that on some upcoming episodes. We actually touched upon it at the prior episode, episode 32 of The Far Middle. But I think we'll have more to assess and say in coming episodes. I think that about, you know, brings this episode 33 to a conclusion. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm going to wrap with something that that I read. I talked about theater and optics. That sort of has been a theme of this episode of The Far Middle. I recently came across something that sort of bothered me, a bit of a bummer. Superman, the Man of Steel, and if you look at the comic book, DC Comics has the rights to Superman. So the Man of Steel, his motto, of course, what did it used to be when we were kids, and what was Superman's motto? Truth, justice, and the American way, right? That's what the Man of Steel embodied. He was the defender of those things. And now it's gone from truth, justice, and the American way to something a little bit different. His new motto is truth, justice, and a better tomorrow. So the American way has been jettisoned and a better tomorrow has been adopted in its place. Now, I sort of read up on this when I saw that. I said, what's this all about? So I tracked this down via DC Comics. And you know, their view was that Superman, his character was evolving, and the new credo was a better reflection of the storylines that they want to tell. So very interesting times that we're living in. Although I will point out, I didn't know this. I sort of figured it out or saw it when I was doing sort of the prep for this this episode of The Far Middle. The American way part of the credo was not always the case. That was adopted. That was added during World War II. So that sort of reflected the patriotism and the effort to build morale during World War II. So, you know, I guess things change. That's the one constant in life, is, as we said earlier, everything changes. Time flies, right? Those two things coupled together. But I thought you'd enjoy that when you see the Man of Steel next in a comic book or on TV, you may not hear Truth, Justice, and the American Way. Get ready for hearing Truth, Justice, and a Better Tomorrow. With all that, I hope you enjoyed, as I said, this episode of The Far Middle. Precipice, the Left's campaign to destroy America, hits shelves and stores in a few short weeks. Give it a pre-order if you haven't already, and I will talk to you soon. Till then, take care.